as in 1987 to 1992, and of course, this most recent one. Meanwhile, California's thirsty population has almost doubled in just four decades, from 22 million to close to 40 million. And the even more thirsty agriculture industry has doubled its acreage planted in almond and pistachio orchards and vineyards, which require water permanently and cannot be fallowed during droughts. Climate change does not cause California's droughts, but it has certainly made their repercussions far worse. The water storage and distribution system, built in the generally wet 20th century, depends on a large snowpack remaining high in the Sierra Nevada into mid and late summer. The latest research predicts the snowpack throughout the West could fall by 60% in the next 30 years. In what were considered normal years, the snowpack supplied about 30% of California's water. With warmer temperatures, 2014 was the warmest year on record in California, followed closely by 2015 and 2016. Snow melts faster, and therefore earlier in the mountains. More precipitation comes as rain, not snow, and water evaporates faster from plants, soil, rivers, and reservoirs. Climate change will also cause more precipitation to occur in extreme events. Extreme droughts followed by extreme storms, basically what happened in the 2016-2017 winter. Rather than recharging underground water supplies, precipitation could be lost as runoff, or worse, from big storms as floods. So even if precipitation stays at normal levels, the water system will be under ever-increasing pressure. Fighting for control of water has been the habitual way of life since California's earliest days. The few moments of progress have been spurred by droughts. The most recent episode, and the likelihood of a new era of the forever drought, functionally speaking, has been a critical opportunity to dramatically change our past habits and contentions and replace them with bold revisions. And it did happen. Standing under a cloudless sky in a high Sierra meadow, Governor Jerry Brown ordered California's first ever mandatory rationing of water in April 2015. Typically, on that date, 5 feet of snow would have covered the ground. Instead, the scene was brown, because that was the fourth year of the most severe drought in 1,200 years. Emergency regulations required all urban areas to reduce water use by 25% on average. And the extraordinary measures succeeded. Californians replaced their old, inefficient toilets, faucets, and showerheads with state-of-the-art low-flow devices, and they cut back on watering their verdant lawns. During the summer, at least half of urban water use is outdoors. In sum, they decreased their water consumption by 26%. From 2013 levels. Quite astonishing. In less than a year, from June 2015 through April 2016, Californians saved 1.43 million acre-feet of water, more than any imaginable new reservoir could store. They produced that water at virtually no expense, and billions were not spent on new dams and reservoirs. But then came one winter of nearly normal precipitation, mostly in the northern regions, and the Governor and State Water Resources Control Board, SWRCB, instantly executed an about-face and retreated from the brief regime of responsible conservation. Most of the state's citizens had willingly done their part to deal with the drought and had accepted the wisdom of the conservation measures. But the regulators couldn't withstand pressure from the utilities that sold water to these customers. The utilities had a point. Conservation had dramatically reduced revenues, but not their overhead costs, including staffing, water treatment, pipeline maintenance, and debt obligations. Post-rationing, the water merchants were allowed to set their own consumption targets based on their own estimates of future shortages. 84% of them, including utilities in Los Angeles, San Diego, Sacramento, and Fresno, jettisoned all water restrictions. Conservation target, zero. After last year's exceptional rain and snow, the SWRCB ended in April 2017, the requirement for even these self-determined conservation targets. The so-called emergency drought measures that remain in effect do little more than prohibit watering your lawn during or immediately after it rains, or hosing down your sidewalk. As we have seen, the drought has produced cooperation and progress among the competing interests in the Colorado River Basin, including those in Southern California. But given this second consecutive wet winter, what hope is there for the state as a whole? Perhaps the entire state can get on board, and not just for 9 months. Who knows? California could even revert to stricter rules for water use, because most leaders finally do recognize that 1 or 2 good years of rain and snow do not change the big picture. Weather predictions for El Niño wet or La Niña dry conditions don't really matter anymore. Climate change is the new normal, and there's nothing normal about it. Changing urban conservation practices will help with the ongoing water predicament. Installing new household water-saving devices and reducing landscape irrigation, but they won't fix it. Not when agriculture uses 4 times more water, 80% of the total. Another way to think about the issue, the same 80-20 usage ratio between agriculture and urban customers during the previous major drought, 1987 through 1992, still holds now, but 9 million more people live in the state. Per capita urban use has declined dramatically, while the total water use by agriculture has remained steady. The public, including all those suburban dwellers skimping on their lawns, has not missed this fact. The ag sector is clearly in the public eye. Which crops use the most water? Couldn't we just eliminate those? Cotton and rice were last century's villains, using considerable amounts of water while also receiving federal subsidies. Cotton production in California is down by more than 2/3 in just the last 10 years. Rice acreage decreased nearly 20% in the last 10 years. Recently, almonds became the new poster crop for wanton water use. We hear that it takes a gallon of water to grow one nut. Alfalfa also tops the list of worst guzzlers. In the most simplistic terms, those allegations are true. But the reality on the ground is more complicated, as always, when the subject is water. Take rice. The flooded rice fields in the upper Sacramento Valley provide critical waterfowl habitat on the remnants of the vast Pacific Flyway, and the Nigiri Project, named for the sushi morsel, is demonstrating that juvenile salmon fatten up on aquatic bugs in the flooded rice fields and are therefore more likely to survive in the ocean and return to spawn. Moreover, the water on these fields either recharges groundwater or is released to the Sacramento River for downstream users. Or take almonds. California's production almost doubled between 2003 and 2015 to an estimated 1.1 million acres. Most of that new planting is in the southern Central Valley, Fresno, Merced, Kern, and Madera counties, where water availability is already extremely challenged. As water became more precious, growers were naturally incentivized to switch to crops that generate more revenue. In 2015, roughly the same acreage was planted in almonds and alfalfa, but the market value of the nuts was $5.3 billion against only $1 billion for the alfalfa. This is why the more thirsty almonds were being planted, even in the drought. On a per-acre basis, alfalfa uses more water in California than almonds and pistachios combined, so it should be the crop to kill during a drought. However, alfalfa is excellent dairy feed, and California is the leading dairy state in the nation, producing nearly 20% of the U.S. supply in 2015. More to the point, dairy's economic value of $6.3 billion topped all the state's other crops individually. Alfalfa uses so much water because it is harvested as many as 10 times in California's warm, year-round growing season. But turn off the water and the plant does not die. It just goes dormant. Turn the water back on, and the crop comes back strong and quickly. If farmers think their water supply might be curtailed, alfalfa is a great crop. It also enriches the soil by nitrogen fixation and provides habitat for birds and beneficial insects. Almonds, as well as pistachios, other tree nuts, and grapevines, are permanent crops that cannot survive without irrigation every year, thereby creating an inflexible, hard demand for water, even in the worst drought. Moreover, they generally require 3 to 5 years of growth before producing decent yields. Looking at the bottom line, almonds may well make more sense. Looking at drought possibilities, alfalfa may prevail. In any event, calling out one crop or another will not solve the drought. Nor is any state or federal regulatory agency going to tell farmers what to plant. That's just un-American. We have free markets. But of course, we don't have free markets. With its continuing inequities in water rights and costs, California's incessantly adjudicated scheme for distributing water is a far cry from a free market. Water rights have a pecking order based on seniority and type of use. The oldest claims date to the Gold Rush era, when miners sucked water from streams to blast gold out of the Sierra Nevada foothills. The mayor of San Francisco assured his city's legal right to water by tacking a handwritten notice on a tree next to the Tuolumne River in 1902. Any individual who started diverting or appropriating water prior to 1914 has a senior water right. Those with later junior rights are the first to lose water in times of shortage. This hierarchy was not a problem when there was enough water for all. But the recent drought resulted in unprecedented water cuts for agriculture that were not equally shared. In 2014 and 2015, the Central Valley Project, CVP, the Federal Water Management Project under the supervision of the Bureau of Reclamation, delivered 40% and 75%, respectively, of their contracted amounts to the farmers with pre-1914 senior rights. But nothing at all to almost everyone else, almost two-thirds of CVP's contractors. In June 2015, during the fourth year of drought, after the state had rationed urban water users and drastically reduced junior agricultural appropriators, the State Water Resources Control Board was obliged to curtail the rights of senior holders. This was astonishing news. It had happened only one other time in history. During the drought of 1976 through 1977. Those with rights established between 1903 and 1914 could no longer draw water in the Sacramento or San Joaquin watersheds or those rivers' combined delta. Soon thereafter, the Water Board issued a $1.5 million fine against the Byron-Bethany Irrigation District, which enjoys a 1914 diversion right, for illegally diverting water for 2 weeks after the curtailment order was issued. After delivering that historic fine, and apparently showing some real enforcement muscle, the board dismissed the entire fine not quite a year later. It still claimed authority to take actions against senior water rights holders, but said that it lacked sufficient data to legally demonstrate Byron-Bethany's violations. This brings up a very sore point among many of the interested parties in the water wars. California lacks the most basic data on agricultural water usage. Two separate agencies regulate water use, the State Water Resources Control Board, SWRCB, and the Department of Water Resources, DWR, but neither has good numbers. The DWR estimates irrigated crop acreage, and the most recent figures are from 2010. We don't actually know how much water the growers are applying to their fields. We don't know how much they're drawing from rivers and streams, or how much groundwater they're pumping. No wonder water is always in dispute, especially during a drought. How can you manage what you can't measure? That's like trying to lose 10 pounds without the honesty of a bathroom scale. Good data are essential to solving California's water challenges. In contrast, each of the more than 400 municipal water utilities now report average per capita usage every month to the SWRCB, and the public has online access to that data. In January 2016, this board finally adopted regulations requiring all holders of surface water rights to report their diversions. The fifth year of drought made it difficult to argue against such reporting. On April 1st, 2017, the largest water diverters will begin measuring and reporting diversions. Certainly, better accounting of water rights, stricter reporting of water use, and more measuring gauges on rivers and creeks will give regulators a better grasp of the water situation and, we can hope, more efficient management. With its arcane system of senior and junior water rights, surface water is not wholly a free-for-all. It is at least somewhat managed. With groundwater, unrestrained use has been the rule, except in limited areas where the courts have intervened, cut off their surface water, and ag users tap into the groundwater beneath their fields and pump as much as needed. Wells are expensive, so alfalfa growers might push the pause button for that cooperative crop. But with permanent crops, like almonds or grapes, fallowing is not an option. It's switch or die. In a typical year, groundwater supplies 40% of California's total water supply, and during dry years, more than 60%, sometimes more. This is an alarming number, because the groundwater is being sucked up at alarming rates, with nearly 70% of the withdrawal in areas categorized by the DWR as high priority for potential overuse and subsidence, mostly in the Sacramento and San Joaquin valleys, combined the Central Valley. In some areas, the groundwater has dropped 50 feet, in a few, 100 feet. Agriculture rains in every one of these overdrafted areas. Groundwater depletion is not limited to California. The aquifers in the lower Mississippi Basin and the Ogallala in the High Plains have diminished considerably in the last 75 years. We know some of these facts thanks to the work, not of the state's two regulatory agencies, but of Jay Famoletti, a senior water scientist at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, who has been working on ways to study groundwater depletion from space. Another reason to keep those satellites orbiting. Talk about the benefits of cool technology. When a land area either gains or loses a large volume of water, the change in mass allows satellites, in this case the twin GRACE satellites, to detect the difference in the gravitational pull. Areas with more mass have more gravitational pull. Using the GRACE readings, Famoletti and his team determined that in just the first 2 years of the most recent drought, the Central Valley lost 8 million acre-feet of groundwater each year, slightly less than the entire urban and industrial water budget for the state. Normally, shallow aquifers at depths of, say, 100 feet are recharged from rain and melting snow percolating downward through the soil, though it may take years or decades, depending on the local geology. As more wells draw more groundwater, water is used faster than it is replenished. Shallow wells run dry. Digging deeper wells is expensive. Small communities that rely on groundwater and have no emergency recourse to storage or connection to other supplies have been hit hard. Drought caused water shortages for an estimated 500,000 Californians, with a large proportion located in low-income and disadvantaged communities served by small water systems. East Porterville, an unincorporated, predominantly Latino community 75 miles southeast of Fresno, remains the hardest hit by the drought. The wells in this community of almost 2,000 homes started failing in the summer of 2014. Contamination took its toll as well. These shallow wells are polluted with nitrates from agricultural fertilizers. The Department of Water Resources completed a new, deeper well over a year later. After another year, the first homes were connected. By the end of 2017, everyone in East Porterville should once again, and finally, after 3+ years, have clean water. Then they will disconnect the temporary 2,500-gallon storage tanks sitting in their front yards, which were replenished by trucks delivering water for washing and cleaning, but not drinking. For drinking, it has been bottled water, and a lot of it. Overdrafting groundwater also causes land to sink. There's less water to hold it up, literally, and once the land collapses, it doesn't recover. Fortunately, a foot of lost groundwater doesn't yield a foot of subsidence. Such a one-to-one correlation would be truly catastrophic. But in the San Joaquin Valley near Los Baños and Kettleman City, land subsided several feet between 2007 and 2011. In other locations in the valley, land sank nearly a foot in less than a year. Sinking land levels are now causing damage to the San Joaquin Valley's bridges, roads, and irrigation canals. The subsidence caused by farmers taking so much groundwater will make it harder to get water south because canals and aqueducts are sinking too. In one location, the main channel of the state water project sank 2 feet. Water could still flow, but in lower quantities, 20% less, in order to avoid spilling over the top of the aqueduct. The Delta Mendota Canal, a major artery for the federal Central Valley Project, also fell about 2 feet in one area. Two subsidence bowls, encompassing hundreds of square miles, are growing wider and deeper as farmers pump more and more groundwater. State regulators are considering restricting groundwater pumping in these areas to protect the California Aqueduct and the Delta Mendota Canal, both critical for state and federal water deliveries. In 2009, California's state legislature mandated the creation of a statewide groundwater monitoring network with public dissemination of this data. But there's still a long way to go. And monitoring is not managing. In 2014, incredibly, California remained the last state in the West that did not regulate groundwater use. In that year, thanks to the drought, the legislature broke new ground with a bill requiring farmers and other well operators to report how much groundwater they are drawing. Local officials were charged with managing groundwater sustainably, including limiting overdrafts and recharging underground water supplies for the most stressed aquifers, but not until 2040. That's not a typo. It is a quarter century, and who knows how many droughts down the road. Shouldn't we require sustainability sooner? And another question. Even if we have the vital data on groundwater withdrawals and use it to regulate them, how much water is left in the aquifers? Big question. Right now, no one knows the answer. Decentralized groundwater management could make sense in California because local conditions vary significantly. But when the water problems are extremely severe and statewide, as is true with groundwater, a universal approach is also needed. For instance, a statewide policy barring planting of new orchards and vineyards or prohibiting the drilling of new wells in the critically overdrafted aquifers until the groundwater is sustainably managed would be more effective than a patchwork of different local restrictions. This isn't telling farmers what to plant, but it is telling them whether to plant. Still, neither the small nor the large growers are helpless bystanders in all this. They can do a lot on their own. They must. The California Water Plan update for 2013, next update, 2018, a lot can change in 5 years, reported that more than 40% of agriculture land in the state used gravity irrigation. This is more commonly labeled flood irrigation, and there are more efficient ways to do the same job. Rice is the exception and must be flooded. Micro or drip irrigation was applied to 39% of California's acreage. Acreage watered with the low-volume irrigation methods had increased by 16% between 2001 and 2011, while the acreage with flood irrigation decreased by 13%. Those numbers are positive, but they relate to the years before the current drought started. No one knows whether farmers are switching to micro or drip irrigation more rapidly now. We do know that it is not the dominant technique, as it should be, and as it is in Israel, for example, where nearly every farm uses drip irrigation. Other irrigation improvements could increase the efficiency of water use. Smart technology can schedule irrigation when crops most need it. Drones can monitor field moisture levels. Regulated deficit irrigation, RDI, can limit water use during a crop's more drought-tolerant growth stages. Research on RDI for tree and vine crops in California began in the 1990s. Wine grapes exemplify its benefits. Mild stress from less water imposed during certain times in the growing season decreases canopy growth, but produces grapes with higher sugar content, better color, and smaller berries with a higher skin-to-fruit volume ratio. RDI is now a common practice in California's wine regions. It could be applied to raisins and those thirsty almonds and pistachios. And new research at UC Davis indicates reducing water use by 25% in alfalfa results in only 5% reduction in yield. Engage all the gears, and just how much water could agriculture save? The Natural Resources Defense Council and the Pacific Institute have estimated a potential 20%, give or take. That estimate assumes that no acreage is fallowed. What if some were fallowed and replanted with solar farms? This might be the best choice in areas where poor drainage has built up salts in the soil, making farming tenuous. It's certainly an idea worth considering in Westlands, the largest irrigation district in the world, with 1,000 square miles of farmland on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley. The natural occurring selenium in its soil produces toxic agricultural runoff. Of course, not all the saved water could actually be used elsewhere or recharge groundwater. But no one denies that there is considerable potential for serious reductions in water use by agriculture. Even if today's existing water sources miraculously produced enough for all Californians, the other problem would still remain. Much of the supply is in the north, and much of the demand is in the south, directly analogous to the disproportional lay of the water demand in the Colorado River Basin to the east. The problem is foundational in both cases, and the infrastructure complexities and battles in both regions stem directly from this geographical imbalance. The Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta is the hub of California's whole scheme. The Delta also happens to be the largest estuary from Alaska to Patagonia, covering about 1,000 square miles, roughly the size of Rhode Island. More than 120 species of fish live in these waterways, including a number that are endangered or threatened, namely the Delta smelt, green sturgeon, and winter and spring run Chinook salmon. Steelhead and striped bass live there too. Once an idyllic, alluvial maze of shifting river channels and sloughs, the Delta is now largely an agricultural region with 1,000 miles of levees, transforming the natural tidal marsh into stable islands for farming. Lured by its fertile soil, farmers arrive during the gold rush to grow fruit for the miners. With level land and year-long available water, growing almost anything was simple and easy. Those farmers made guaranteed riches, while the nearby miners in the Sierra Nevada did not. Yet that same rich soil has over time subsided below sea level, making the levees crucial. This being California, many earthquake faults lie close to the Delta, with a few passing just underneath. The wrong earthquake could rupture everything. The disruption would be unspeakable. The experts put the probability of a significant seismic event in the nearby San Francisco Bay Area sometime in the next quarter century at 70%. To send water south, the Federal Central Valley Project and the State Water Project withdraw water from the Delta. It is the lifeblood for two-thirds of the state's residents, including half of Southern California and virtually all of the San Joaquin Valley's agriculture. Both projects rely on sets of enormous pumps in Tracy, on the southern edge of the Delta, to pull water into their equally enormous canals for distribution southward. Two problems arise when river flows dwindle in the summer and early fall, and those pumps draw water unnaturally southward. First, fish, including the Delta smelt and migratory salmon, are sucked into the pumps. Second, drawing water out of the Delta allows salt water from San Francisco Bay to seep into the Delta. If that salt water were to reach the pumps, thanks to tides, sea level rise, or low outflows in summer or fall. The water supply for all the farms and cities south of the delta would be rendered unusable. Clearly, too much is being asked of this delta, and has been for decades. So far, the water flowing south has remained okay. The fish haven't been as lucky. During his first State House residency, 1975 through 1983, Governor Brown proposed the Peripheral Canal, basically a massive shipping channel around the inland edge of the delta, to improve water transfer to the south and protect the fish. Northern Californians consider this a water grab by Southern California, and a few wealthy San Joaquin Valley farmers believe the new canal wouldn't deliver them enough water. This unholy alliance led to a resounding ballot box defeat of the project in 1982. Of course, the stresses and the threats didn't go away, and attempts to address them didn't stop. Nor did they advance. In June 1994, an amalgamation of 25 local, state, and federal agencies and other organizations with disparate interests in the Delta signed an agreement to protect it with a new long-term solution. CalFed spawned lots of meetings, memos, and even a record of decision to improve the Delta, but not much real-world action. A decade passed. In 2007, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger created the Delta Vision Blue Ribbon Task Force, which declared that protecting the ecosystem and ensuring a reliable water supply were the primary co-equal goals for sustainable management of the Delta. An important new concept, maybe worth the paper it was printed on. But again, no concrete steps followed to protect the Delta. Finally, in 2009, Schwarzenegger convened an extraordinary session of the legislature a month after it had gone home for the year, only the seventh such convocation in its history, to deal with the state's water conundrums. After 12 exhausting days and nights, the legislatures passed a package of bills to protect the Delta, improve water conservation, and begin monitoring groundwater levels. The Delta Stewardship Council would create a comprehensive management plan for the Delta. The Department of Water Resources would draft a multi-species conservation plan. If DWR's Bay Delta Conservation Plan, BDCP, complied with federal and state endangered species and habitat protection laws, it would be incorporated into the Council's Delta Plan. But then, in 2011, it was out with Arnold Schwarzenegger and back in with Jerry Brown for a second tenure as governor. The man really wants to resolve California's water woes, though not without extraordinary measures. Last time, it was the peripheral canal. This time, the 2013 BDCP includes two gargantuan tunnels, each 40 feet in diameter, twice the size of the channel, the pair of train tunnels that run beneath the English Channel between the United Kingdom and France. The intakes just south of Sacramento would be 7 feet above current sea level, and possibly safe from current predictions of future sea level rise, would burrow 150 feet under the delta for 35 miles, and would move up to 9,000 cubic feet of water per second, down to the pumps at Tracy. This scale rivals the previous century's major dam building. The $17 billion construction costs, as required by law, would be borne entirely by the various contractors who would receive the water. The plan also aimed to restore more than 100,000 acres of the Delta for $8 billion. The hope was that the comprehensive approach would yield 50-year permits from federal and state regulators for the water exports. However, neither the feds nor the state could grant these approvals due to uncertainty over the benefits of the restoration and the consequences of a changing climate. And in April 2015, Governor Brown proposed a seismic shift in approach. The new idea was to disentangle ecosystem restoration and the new infrastructure fix, the tunnels. Under the new California Water Fix, the state would proceed with the tunnel project and restore just 2,000 acres of habitat as mitigation for the direct impact of construction. As before, the tunnels would be funded entirely by the customers downstream. The restoration, codename EcoRestore, would be a scaled-down effort targeting just 30,000 acres, as opposed to the previous 100,000. The details behind every aspect of these plans, including the regulatory hurdles, are mind-boggling. Deficiencies in the original environmental evaluations of WaterFix, of both the tunnels and the water exports, have led environmental and delta protection groups to ask for a do-over of those assessments. In the summer of 2016, a California court ruled that the plans for WaterFix lacked legally required enforceable and measurable targets to protect the delta. This ruling is under appeal, of course. Additional delays guaranteed. And in March 2017, the NOAA Fisheries cast still more doubt on the project in its draft biological opinion, stating the tunnels would harm salmon, steelhead, delta and longfin smelt, and other fish and wildlife species, and diminish water quality. Let's assume, against all the history and current odds, that this enormous project could get all the regulatory approvals and withstand the legal challenges. There's still the financing to conquer. The cost will always be uncertain, because in the history of the world, large infrastructure projects have virtually never come in on time and within budget. A pertinent local example was the new eastern span of the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, initially estimated to cost $1.2 billion and take 5 years to complete. In the end, the cost more than quintupled, and the job took 11 years. So it is written, and not just here, that the current $17 billion price tag for the Delta job will almost certainly go up, and the 10-year time frame could prove wildly optimistic. An unpublished economic analysis of WaterFix, obtained via a Public Records Act request by Restore the Delta, a Stockton-based environmental group, indicated that even a nearly $4 billion subsidy from the federal government wouldn't make the official $17 billion price cost-effective for agriculture. What happens when the costs borne by the water customers inevitably go up? Trouble down the line is guaranteed. Under the present budget, the state estimates that the water contractors will owe more than $1.4 billion in annual financing costs after 2032. The agricultural contractors would add hundreds of millions to their debt costs annually, and this money would be owed to private lenders, not to the state or federal governments, which might be amenable to waiving interest fees or accepting less than full repayment. This has happened in the past, with the Central Valley Project, in fact, compliments of the Bureau of Reclamation. Even the Obama administration signed a deal in 2016 with Westlands, the huge irrigation district on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley, forgiving its $375 million interest-free repayment obligation to taxpayers for construction of the Central Valley Project because the feds failed to complete a drain to remove the naturally occurring yet highly toxic selenium in the area's soil. Wall Street doesn't usually work like that, nor would it appreciate the joke that the general manager of Westlands made after the district was fined $125,000 by the SEC for misleading investigators regarding a bond issue. Hardly a crushing financial blow, yet still the largest fine ever for a municipal bond issuer. It didn't help their credit rating. This official described the false recalculations as a little Enron accounting. These environmental and financial issues are disturbing enough, but perhaps worse would be the repercussions of this massive infrastructure spending on urban conservation, recycling, and local water supply. The Metropolitan Water District of Southern California wholesales water to districts in six counties: Los Angeles, San Bernardino, San Diego, Orange, Riverside, and Ventura, with 19 million urban residents. The Met is an ardent proponent of the tunnels. Paying for one quarter of their cost, a fair assumption, would mean $300 million annually that local water districts in Southern California cannot spend on water recycling, conservation, or other local water supply projects. Some of the easiest and most efficient opportunities for conservation exist here. Water's version of low-hanging fruit. Recycling and stormwater capture hold great promise for reducing the need for imports from the Delta, But the Met continues to push the tunnels and has even purchased 5 islands in the Delta for $175 million. Locals doubt this is anything but a water grab, since owning land where the tunnels might go or where dredge fill is placed would eliminate some local property fights. The preceding paragraphs are the barest possible sketch of what's in store for the twin tunnels. The legal, political, and financial hurdles are nothing less than Himalayan. And this is good. A better approach is to invest in protecting the Delta levees, conserve and decrease water use in both the agricultural and urban sectors, then look at new sources of water, though not reservoirs, which are less complicated than tunnels from a construction standpoint, but are comparably challenged legally, politically, and environmentally. Given California's long coastline, desalination is probably the first new source of water that comes to mind. Without fresh water, but with plenty of oil, Saudi Arabia relies on desal for most of its drinking water. Israel draws a quarter of its water from the technology. During its so-called millennium drought, which lasted 14 years, Australia spent $10 billion constructing 6 desalination plants, but only 2 are used today. One reason is the return of rainfall. The other is the abiding problem with the technology. It's really expensive and very energy intensive. In California, widespread adoption could actually reverse the state's progress toward the goal set in its 2006 landmark global warming law, which requires the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions to 1990 levels by 2020. In 2016, Governor Brown signed into law a new goal to slash those emissions even further, 40% below 1990 levels by 2030. Desal also poses 2 serious environmental threats: seawater intakes, sucking in marine species, and the disposal of the brine sludge waste, which is far saltier than seawater. The state requires future desal projects to use subsurface intakes to reduce harm to marine life, but these raise the already considerable costs further. And it takes roughly 2 gallons of seawater to produce 1 gallon of potable water. The cost problem was proved in Santa Barbara, which built a facility in the early 1990s during another 4-year drought. Completed in 1992, the $35 million plant operated for only 3 months before the rains returned, and it was shut. Then residents still had to pay off the construction costs. With the recent drought, the city council voted in 2015 to restart the plant. Well, not restart. The technology has advanced considerably in the last 2 decades. The Affluent Paradise is spending $55 million to tear down the old plant and build a new one that is 40% more energy efficient and reduces the harm to marine life with better screens on the intake pipes. Scheduled to start operation in late May of 2017, the plant will eventually deliver 30% of the community's water. Time, or further winter rains in the years ahead, will tell whether this is a wise investment or Santa Barbara will yet again be paying for an expensive, unnecessary asset for years. Right now in the state, a dozen seawater desal plants are producing almost 63,000 acre-feet of water annually, with 50,000 acre-feet coming from 1 new facility in Carlsbad, near San Diego. This operation, built for $1 billion by Poseidon Water of Boston, was originally proposed during the drought in the early 1990s, at the time importing 85% of its water from the Delta and the Colorado River. San Diego wanted more local supplies. This made sense, but obtaining it required about 25 years, many of them devoted to fending off more than a dozen lawsuits, including some from environmental groups. After finally starting operation in December 2015, the Poseidon plant ultimately should provide about 8% of the San Diego region's water supply. This water is expensive, $2,300 per acre foot, and the local authority is under contract to buy at least 48,000 acre feet per year for 30 years. A stipulation that was crucial for Poseidon to obtain financing. The price is almost twice as much as San Diego is paying for its imported water. It is also roughly twice the cost of recycling wastewater and quadruple the cost of saving water through conservation and rebates for drip irrigation, lawn removal, or water-efficient toilets. Yet, remarkably, desal remains in the running for some cities. Perhaps the desire to make the ocean drinkable is more technologically tempting than boring old conservation. While most of the focus is on seawater, the technology can also purify brackish or contaminated groundwater. In fact, California currently has more such capacity than seawater capacity, even with Poseidon's plant in production. There are now 22 brackish groundwater plants in Southern California urban areas, and one in the Bay Area. Recycling water, in some contexts this perhaps sounds a bit more palatable than reusing water, has tremendous potential to provide more reliable local water sources than imports from great distances. During a drought, outdoor irrigation is the homeowner's first cut. Indoor use is the top priority, so recycled water is, in effect, drought-resistant. The public, especially in urban areas, should welcome recycling. Israel treats and reuses 85% of its wastewater. In the United States, California's own Irvine Ranch Water District in central Orange County pioneered recycling in the 1980s. The wastewater is treated to meet California standards for non-potable use and now supplies 21% of the district's demand, primarily for agricultural and landscape irrigation via purple pipes, now the international symbol for recycled water. The neighboring Orange County Water District recharges its groundwater basin, the largest source of local drinking water, with highly treated wastewater. It's a three-step process, and currently the world's largest system for indirect potable reuse. The system came online in 2008 and can produce 100 million gallons of water per day, enough for 850,000 residents. The district also provides recycled water for landscape irrigation at parks, golf courses, schools, industrial processes, and power generation cooling. Without any grants factored in, the cost is $850 per acre foot, which is cheaper than imported supplies. Even Los Angeles's Metropolitan District, one of the strongest proponents of the twin tunnels under the Delta to the north, is actively conducting feasibility studies for recycling water currently released into the Pacific Ocean. As we have seen, San Diego's costs for water imported from the Colorado River have tripled in the last 15 years and continue to rise. Recycling is one of its answers, and not just for irrigation or industrial uses. An advanced water purification plant in operation since 2011 is projected to soon produce 30 million gallons of drinking water per day, and almost three times that much by 2035. Water recycling could benefit agriculture, too. Soon, the treated wastewater from the Central Valley communities of Turlock and Modesto will be used by farmers in the Del Puerto Water District and wildlife refuges. As much as 30,000 acre-feet per year could be available by 2018. Recycled water should be a self-evident option for urban as well as agricultural purposes. And in 2013, the State Water Resources Control Board adopted goals to increase its use over 2002 levels by at least 1 million acre-feet annually by 2020, 2 million by 2030. The board has streamlined permitting by local authorities. It also plans to allow adding recycled water directly into public water systems and raw water supplies directly upstream of a treatment plant. Direct potable reuse. And at the other end of the scale, the individual home, there are new options emerging besides just DIY gray water systems. KB Homes, one of the United States' largest home builders, features a double-zero home in a 990-acre planned community in El Dorado Hills, near Sacramento. This three-bedroom, two-bath home is designed to produce all its electricity with solar panels and store it with batteries. This accounts for one of the zeros in the name. The other refers to the Nexus e-water system that collects and purifies gray water from showers and bathroom sinks and sends it to the sprinklers. The second zero is for no potable water for landscape irrigation. This integrated system is the first certified by the state to meet plumbing code standards. It will conserve as much as 70% of the water in a comparable conventional home. As Joni Mitchell sings, they paved paradise and put up a parking lot. All this impervious tarmac prevents water from soaking into the ground to recharge aquifers. Instead, the runoff picks up waste, metals, chemicals, and other contaminants, and then dumps the pollution into rivers, lakes, and ocean. A rare upside to the drought has been improved water quality at Southern California's beaches. Capturing stormwater and rainwater runoff should be mandatory for augmenting local water supplies and reducing environmental hazards. If ever there was a winter to prove this, it was 2017. The state has set goals comparable to the ones for recycling to increase the use of stormwater. It should go further to set baseline requirements for stormwater capture with all new development and municipal stormwater permits. In the Pajaro Valley, south of Santa Cruz, landowners are getting paid to store stormwater in order to recharge groundwater. The valley's agriculture, 35% of the nation's strawberries are grown there, relies almost entirely on groundwater, and the remaining 2% is recycled water. It's a complete no-brainer. Capturing stormwater enhances flood control, recharges the groundwater supply, improves water quality, and protects and helps restore habitats. In some ways, the most important result of the 2009 extraordinary session of the legislature, dedicated to fixing the issues with the Delta, was the policy to reduce reliance on its water by increasing local supplies through recycling, stormwater capture, and conservation. This is also the suite of water management tools that Governor Brown endorsed in his 2016 California Water Action Plan. Yet Brown is inconsistent. His constant press for the big tunnels under the Delta may demotivate utilities and agriculture from pursuing those options. What could be less exciting than nothing big to build, plain vanilla, conservation? And what water could be cheaper to produce? This was proved during the 10 months of mandatory rationing in 2015 and 2016, when California as a whole reduced consumption by 25%. Using less water also reduced energy use, because nearly 20% of California's electricity use is water-related, including transporting, pumping, treating, and heating. According to a UC Davis study, conservation between June 2015 and February 2016 saved nearly 1 million megawatts of electricity and reduced greenhouse gas emissions by 220,000 megatons, equivalent to removing 50,000 cars from the road for a year. This mandatory rationing was rescinded in the spring of 2016, but the Water Action Plan 2016 update still insisted that conservation must become a way of life for everyone in California. It's not hard to do. About half of urban water use is for landscaping, with peak usage during the summer. Let your ornamental turf go golden, as the State Water Board put it. Still operative rebate programs induce residents to replace their thirsty lawns with drought-tolerant plantings. The California Department of Water Resources requires new yards and commercial landscaping to use about 20% less water and employ compost to improve the water-holding capacity of soil. New building codes in 2015 reduce water use in all new buildings. By this point, all such urban conservation measures must be considered boilerplate, starting with low-flow toilets and other indoor fixtures and appliances, and going from there. It all adds up. What is not yet boilerplate, and should be, is the smart meter that encourages even more conservation. Some areas in California still don't have metering at all, but all are required to by 2025. Traditional water meters determine the bill based on total consumption for the billing period. The utility has no idea how much water is used each day, let alone what time of day. Smart meters collect and transmit this data to the utility, just as gas and electric utilities have done for some time. There's nothing like friendly peer competition when you see your usage compared to another average local household's. More important, evidence of slow, steady usage throughout the night probably identifies a leak, and stopping even small leaks on a wide basis would do wonders for the water supply. San Francisco was the first major utility in California to install smart meters for all its customers. In Los Angeles and Ventura, California American Water, a nationwide publicly traded water utility, teamed up with Water Smart Software, a behavioral water efficiency platform using data analytics. The company partners with 38 water utilities throughout North America and monitors water use of over 2 million households, including the East Bay Municipal Utility District. It boasts that its service can trim water use up to 5% in a year, and the service can be deployed in 45 days, which is light years faster than a utility can build a reservoir or water treatment plant. In the 25 years since Mark wrote the first afterword to his book, climate change and severe drought have made water in the American West even more precious. The planet's hottest year on record since 1880 was 2016. 16 of the 17 hottest years have occurred in this century. In the Colorado River Basin, the drought has lasted 16 years and counting. In California, 5 years. The new reality fundamentally challenges the systems of dams, reservoirs, aqueducts, canals, and levees built in the last century, when we really believed we could engineer nature and move water from where it was to where it wasn't. We ought to know better by now. Dams do have benefits. The American Desert West is livable for large numbers of us because of them. But they are perilous, too. The near catastrophe at California's Oroville Dam, if we need a reminder, highlighted our past hubris and should serve as a lesson for our future. Less visually dramatic, but equally alarming. Decades of siphoning water away from the environment to farms and cities have ruined fisheries, as well as river and delta ecosystems. The Colorado River Delta and the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta are in crisis. Wild salmon and other fish are on the brink of extinction. And always, forever, water is at a premium. The red flags are everywhere for water in the American West, but the way forward is not a mystery. It is only a puzzle. We know what needs to be done. Farms and cities must use less water by continuing and increasing conservation, especially in agriculture. Water recycling, stormwater capture, and sustainable groundwater management must become the new normal. Taking down some dams will restore fish habitat. The environment, especially salmon, and the Sacramento, San Joaquin, and Colorado River deltas must get a dedicated and greater share of water. We have the know-how and the technology. The only question is how we actually put them into practice on the necessary scale, given the political and economic barriers. The unprecedented droughts in California and on the Colorado River, as well as record precipitation and floods, may be our last and best chance to dramatically alter our water future. Let's not waste this opportunity. Lori Mott, May 2017. This concludes the reading of Cadillac Desert, revised and updated, The American West and Its Disappearing Water by Mark Reisner. Copyright 1986-1993 by Mark Reisner. This book was read by Joe Spieler and Kate Udall. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with the Spieler Agency and was produced in 2018 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.